And as Mark Serres just said, this winter's Arctic warming isn't related to long-term climate change. But to science writer Alan Anderson, the big-picture trend is clear. The Arctic sea ice will eventually disappear. And he's written a book about it. It's called After the Ice. And Alan Anderson joins me from London. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You say that climate change is more acute in the Arctic than anywhere else, that it's sort of the canary in the coal mine. Give us an example of what you mean.
Well, that's exactly right. And we know that by the fact that the ice there is disappearing so rapidly. You know, every summer now, the ice is vanishing from the Arctic at a speed we would never have even thought of a couple of decades ago.
You describe something in your book which you call the Arctic revenge, something that will affect us living below the Arctic, I presume, at some point.
Once the tundra that rims the Arctic starts to thaw, what we'll see is greenhouse gases pouring out of that tundra. Already in the warmer points around the Arctic, you'll see very odd bubblings in a lake. What you can do, if you're fairly adventurous, is reach out over that little pond and light a match above that bubbling and just get a poof of flame. That is methane bubbling out of lakes as they thaw and microorganisms start to be able to digest basically the humus, the rotten material at the bottom of the lake. Elsewhere, frozen ground is bubbling out carbon dioxide. These are powerful greenhouse gases. As time goes by, the more it thaws, the more will pour out, the more the earth will warm. That's number one. But there are a couple of other things it's got in mind for you too.
A couple of other things?
There's the well-known one, of course, of sea level rise. Sitting on top of Greenland is a vast ice cap. As that melts away, it pours back into the sea and raises sea levels worldwide. If the whole thing melts, sea level rise will be about 23 feet around the world.
That's not going to happen overnight, right? I mean, this isn't something that's going to happen in our lifetime.
No, it would take hundreds, probably thousands of years for all the ice to melt. But once it really gets going, it will become unstoppable.
And the consequences beyond rising sea levels are changes in the weather, for example?
Yes. The wider changes will be changes in the weather and so on. But, you know, for the people of the Arctic and the animals that live in the Arctic, I think we've run out of time because the ice they depend on is going. The ice that sits on top of Greenland, not the sea ice, is a little bit different. We have more chance to save that, quite definitely. But the ice that fills that ocean is going, and I don't think now that we're able to stop it.
How long will it take, based on your estimate, before we reach a point where there is no longer any ice in the Arctic in the summertime?
The very earliest estimates are 2013. Other estimates are 2050. But a broad consensus among scientists seems to be 2030 now.
Alan Anderson, what will the Arctic look like in the summertime by the middle of this century?
Well, it'll be a mostly open sea. And for me, I guess the biggest shock is, you know, I always think of the polar bears when I think of the Arctic. It just comes automatically. The polar bear is the king of the Arctic, the top predator. It'll be gone. And in its place, we will see killer whales. The killer whale will be the new top predator of the Arctic. A killer whale living in open water will be the symbol of the Arctic, you know, replacing a bear on ice. That's an astonishing change.
Describe for me some of the people that you encountered living above the Arctic Circle. I mean, about half of the people who live in the Arctic Circle are members of an indigenous tribe, and the other half, primarily in Russia, as you describe, are people who sort of settled in the area.
Yeah. Well, my very first visit to the Arctic was when I landed at a place called Grisfjord in the very, very northern part of Canada. And there I was really shocked because walking along the beach, I saw seals that had been hunted, other seals that had been cut up. There was the head of a narwhal with its pointed lance, the one that inspired the myth of the unicorn, sitting there. This was a real hunting community, and for me, used to shopping in a supermarket, I was just stunned. But a few months later, when I understood how the Arctic work, I did go out hunting seal with some Inuit people and got to have a feel of how they felt and how they lived.
And in your book, you make the argument that it's not hunting of seals or of the narwhal or the polar bears that is threatening the Arctic, but it is human behavior in most of the rest of the world that is destroying the Arctic.
Yes, of course. It's the warming that we are generating by filling the air with greenhouse gases that's really hammering the Arctic now. And I have to say, it's the third time for them up there. The first wave of southerners were whalers who slaughtered huge numbers of whales and made it very difficult for them to live there. The second wave was air pollution going up south and poisoning the ice. And now we're doing it again with global warming. So they've had it pretty tough from us southerners.
I want to ask you about the politics of the Arctic, because as you write, there are actually serious national security implications for the ice melt, for what's going on in the Arctic, particularly with respect, for example, to U.S.-Russia relations. I mean, there are disputes over who owns what the closer you get to the North Pole, right?
Absolutely. You can't claim the actual water, the fish, or any sort of territorial right, but you can get everything that's on the sea bottom, which means oil, gas, possibly minerals. So that's what everybody's after, the rights to those. I think a very serious problem is developing. As the ice is turning to water, the area becomes much more accessible. As it becomes accessible, you need to be able to police and patrol it. And nobody has the capacity to police and patrol it at the moment.
What needs to happen from a policy perspective, in your view, right now, to preserve the Arctic?
Two big things. The first is, don't put any more stresses on the Arctic. So strict regulation on drilling for oil, any ships trying to go through the Arctic, you know, good search and rescue. If there ever were an oil spill, let's make sure we could deal with it quickly. So let's not do anything else that's going to mess up the Arctic. Control that. At the moment, we don't have the rules, the regulations, and we don't have the ships, the planes to look after the place. And the second thing is, of course, to try to tackle global warming and cut back on our greenhouse gas emissions. And the faster we can do that, the better.
That's Alan Anderson. He is the former editor-in-chief of New Scientist magazine and the author of the book After the Ice, Life, Death, and Geopolitics in the New Arctic. Alan Anderson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This week, federal agents arrested more than a dozen people in the Detroit area in a $14 million Medicare fraud scheme that focused on home health care. The investigation was launched by a federal strike force that's trying to crack down on Medicare and Medicaid fraud. Tim Menke is on that strike force. He's the Deputy Inspector General for Investigations at the Department of Health and Human Services. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Scott. Good to be here.
What are some of the alleged crimes?
Well, it's a crime that is very common, and that is setting up a phony billing system with a home health agency. And what will happen is a beneficiary may be approached, and unfortunately now it seems like in economically depressed areas because they tend to be an easier target for these recruiters. The beneficiary will be offered several hundred dollars for all of their Medicare or Medicaid information. The recruiter will then compile a list. And then that recruiter will get paid roughly $300 to $400. The crook at the top, who set up the phony company, then takes that list and starts billing Medicare because on the surface, it appears the crook got a legitimate provider's license and a provider number.
Potentially, how big is Medicare and Medicaid fraud in this country?
Roughly $60 billion a year. And we recover about $4 billion a year with a B, the Office of Inspector General. It's just the tip of the iceberg. And we see many different patterns across the United States, and we're using data analysis to hone in on this criminal activity and bring these people to justice.
I understand that organized crime and even street gangs have gotten into the act.
Absolutely.
Because it's so lucrative?
Absolutely. It's lucrative and it's safe for them. Why rob a bank and risk getting shot when you can click a mouse and bill Medicare and Medicaid, basically lie on some forms and make millions of dollars doing so.
So if Tony Soprano were real, he conceivably could be clicking a mouse to steal money.
Conceivably, but the way we look at organized crime isn't any particular group or category. We've seen multiple different cultures engaging in organized criminal activity. We see Armenians, Cubans, Nigerians, Russians, Ukrainians, you name it, across the board. They're using very similar methods. And what's disturbing now is we're seeing a viral nature of healthcare fraud going across the United States, where some of these groups are actually merging.
You know, the litany of getting rid of waste, fraud, and abuse has been going on for a generation or more. I'm going to risk asking you if you think some of the projections that have been made about how much money could be saved and maybe poured into a healthcare overhaul plan are realistic.
Well, first of all, I am non-political. So the bottom line is I can tell you what we recovered. Last year we recovered $4 billion, but I feel that's just the tip of the iceberg. It's kind of hard defining how much fraud is actually out there. And it's almost like how many stars are in the sky? Mm-hmm. Billions. And those are the ones we can see.
What are the kind of stories you tell when you go home or talk to friends about some of the more outrageous things you've discovered?
The sheer level of fraud that we're seeing, the audacity, the violence. I think we're a little concerned because of some of the things we're finding on search warrants. Historically, we've taken boxes of paper in a typical fraud investigation. Now, because of the organized crime and street gang influence, we're taking machine guns, automatic weapons, out of facilities that are engaging in healthcare fraud. That's a little disturbing for me. I have roughly 500 special agents assigned to work this healthcare fraud, and it puts a whole new spin on things. It's not the traditional white-collar fraud that we were working 5 years ago. It's getting edgier and more dangerous.
Tim Menke, Deputy Inspector General for Investigations at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Time for sports. NFL playoffs continue this week, and the most compelling characters could be a couple of graybeards trying to get one more chance in the Super Bowl. ESPN's Howard Bryant joins us. Howard, thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott. Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you. Of course, I mean Kurt Warner of the Cardinals and Brett Favre of the Vikings. Now, Kurt Warner had a historic game last week. What is it, just four incompletes but five touchdown passes? But he had to throw so many touchdown passes because the Cards' defense is like a screen door.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be an amazing weekend of football. The only thing that I ask of these players is that they cease and desist with their life and death metaphors with what's going on in Haiti and just play their games. Mm-hmm. But I think that this is going to be one of the best football playoffs going because you have so many motivated teams. You've got a great storyline with Brett Favre trying to get there one more time. He's been to two Super Bowls but hasn't been to one in 11 years. And Kurt Warner, let's not forget that the Cardinals are the defending National Football Conference champions. They lost to the Steelers in the Super Bowl, yeah. So it's not necessarily an upset. They're just defending their crown. You've got the Dallas Cowboys, who finally won a playoff game, and they are the best team going in their conference. And then you've got two other teams that are trying to do something that they've been trying to cap off for a while, which is the Chargers trying to finally get over the hump and go to the Super Bowl, and the Colts, who blew a chance at going undefeated, seemingly on purpose, yeah. And now they're trying to win the Super Bowl for the second time in 3 years.
It's a great lineup. Can I talk about Kurt Warner?
Kurt Warner is tremendous, and let's not forget that when he left the Rams, people thought his career was over. He went to the Giants and didn't do a whole lot there, and he was a backup in Arizona and was supposed to...
Yeah. But you know what he did do? He accepted his backup status. He helped the quarterback that he was supposed to tutor. My point is, everything I read about Kurt Warner convinces me that he is just a sterling human being, up to and including all of his activities in the community. And he plays so well at the age of 38. Tell me he's not on steroids.
Well, I always steer clear of talking about what stellar human beings these athletes are because I don't know them outside of the field. I only know them in their office. But for everything that we've seen, he is a tremendous, tremendous individual. And I agree with you. Most players who have won back-to-back MVPs would pout and complain when they were made a backup. Some of them wouldn't even play at all. I remember Allen Iverson had threatened to retire instead of being made a backup. He wouldn't even sit on the bench for a few minutes. So it does show a complete lack of ego on his part, and the fact that he can still play at this level is also great.
Yesterday, Gilbert Arenas, the Washington Wizards, entered a guilty plea for bringing guns into the team locker room. He said he did it to get them out of his house in Virginia and out of reach of his children, and he brandished them just as a joke. Is he finished in D.C. or the NBA?
It would seem so that he needs at least a new start. He's got too much talent to be finished in the NBA. I think one of the problems that we have in the sports department is we try to make things so simple. This is not a simple case. We have a gun culture in our society, and I think that it trickles into the sports leagues. I remember when I had breakfast with Tony Dungy a couple of weeks ago, and he said when he was coaching the Colts, he asked how many players in the room had guns, and the whole team raised their hand.
Oh,
so this is something that he's going to have to deal with and be responsible for, but at the same time, I think there's a larger question at work, too.
Mm. Well, next time I have breakfast with Peyton Manning, I'll ask him, okay? I had lunch with Tony Dungy. Howard, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Everybody knows Ed Sullivan as the man who first brought Elvis Presley, the Beatles, the Supremes, Woody Allen, Carol Burnett, and Richard Pryor into millions of American homes. But each week, the man who was what amounted to the gatekeeper of American entertainment also presented a parade of plate spinners, marine drill teams, weird animal acts, magicians, ventriloquists, and a tiny little Italian mouse.
What are you going to be when you grow up?
I would like to be a scientist and do experiments.
Hey, that's a wonderful career.
But it's too dangerous for me.
Why do you say that, Topo?
The other scientists might think I'm the experiment.
Well, that's Topo Gigio, of course, our little Italian mouse friend, and, of course, Ed Sullivan. Kind of hard not to do it as an imitation. Gerald Nachman has written a book about Ed Sullivan and the history of his show. It's called Right Here on Our Stage Tonight. Does everyone say that to you, Mr. Nachman?
A lot of people do, and I find myself saying it, even though I don't do a very good Ed Sullivan impression. Everybody in time tries to do that.
Mr. Nachman is joining us from member station KQED in San Francisco. His book is called Right Here on Our Stage Tonight. When all is said and done, when you sweep out all the famous names, was this vaudeville on TV?
He streamlined vaudeville for TV. You know, when you went to a vaudeville show, I never did, I'm not that old, but you would watch maybe 2 hours, 2.5 hours, and every act would be 10 or 15 minutes. Well, he had an hour show, and he cut the comedians down to 5 minutes and a singer down to one or two songs, and he managed to pack in an awful lot into 1 hour.
He would introduce a lot of, retired prize fighters, retired athletes. Just here tonight in our audience, we want to introduce. I'm sorry, this is this is irresistible.
It's catching,
isn't it?
It's catching, yes.
Yeah. You could see Joe Louis, the great old heavyweight champ, would be introduced.
Well, something I found out in researching the book is that obviously those people didn't just happen to be sitting on the aisle in the audience. They were all paid $1,000 to stand up and wave. And he would have everybody on, famous people, war heroes, as you say, prize fighters. And I think the idea was to let everyone watching know that this was the only place to be Sunday nights at 8 o'clock.
That I have been in the newspaper business, I have never seen such a collection of stars in the flesh as are here tonight. Gary Grant, would you stand up and let the cookie see you? Mae West.
The show was not an immediate hit.
Well, the show was a gradual hit. He was an immediate flop. The critics just vilified him because he would freeze up when he got on TV, turned into a cigar store Indian. And eventually he turned that around by becoming kind of an endearing guy, partly through such devices as talking to Topo Gigio, and that helped kind of warm him up. And also everybody came on and did imitations of him, and that kind of established his identity and his persona, and he became famous for being terrible.
But how long, Topo, do you think you'll last in television if you can't sing or dance or act?
Eddie, how long have you been on the air?
Topo, Nobody likes a smart aleck mouse.
We have a really big shoe. A really, really big shoe.
Well, talk to us, please, about our little Italian mouse friend, Topo Gigio.
Well, it was a marionette, and it took six people to move the arms and the legs, and the toes would curl up and the eyes would roll. It was a very peculiar act, and it was also an attempt by Sullivan to appeal to kids.
And it was a show that families would watch together. That was the whole idea of having acts for them. Now something for the kiddies, right?
Unheard of today that the whole family would watch. The grandparents and the parents and the kids would all watch the same show, but the kids watching that show would be exposed to things other than the music that they liked. Mm-hmm. They'd be exposed to comedians. They'd be exposed to, ballet dancers, opera singers, and every level of culture. And their parents, by the same token, would be exposed to rock singers and so on. And so it was really a way of, he really did kind of knit the family together on Sunday nights for an hour anyway.
This song here is one of the saddest songs we've ever heard. It really tells a story, friends. Beautiful lyrics. It goes something like this. You ain't nothing but a...
You know, we could talk about the famous names, but let me ask you about some of the others. Eric Brenn.
Oh, yeah. He was a master plate spinner.
Yeah.
And, they had many, many plate spinners on the show and all kinds of tumblers and acrobats. And
I haven't seen a good plate spinner in years. I haven't seen a bad plate spinner in years.
Where did they all go? That's the question I had after the Sullivan Show went off the air.
Paul Draper, who was a serious dancer, wasn't he?
Right. A great modern dancer, I think. I don't think he was a ballet dancer.
No, he was modern dance.
Yeah, and he was blacklisted from the show, as was Larry Adler, the famous harmonica virtuoso. And
blacklisted because they were blacklisted.
Well, they were blacklisted from TV, and the Sullivan wouldn't have them on, even though his sympathies were rather liberal. Actually, people think of him as, because he looked like a banker or something, that people thought he was a conservative. But he was a lower middle class Irish Catholic who was married to a Jewish woman, had an Italian assistant, but he caved in on the matter. Performers who were tainted in any way, because for him, he was looking out for himself and the show.
To put something on the other side of his ledger, he did put on people like James Brown and the Supremes and Richard Pryor, for that matter, when a lot of other mainstream news organizations wouldn't have him on.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, as everybody knows, Harlem, whenever any new musical trend has evinced itself in the popular field, whether it's the Charleston or the Black Bottom or any of the rhythm songs, the first area to find out about it in advance is Harlem.
He brought black performers onto TV, almost all white TV in the early 50s, more than any other show. He would have Sammy Davis on when he was with the Will Mastin Trio, Pearl Bailey, kind of Harlem specialty acts like Peg Leg Bates, if you remember him.
I was about to ask I couldn't remember his name, but the one-legged dancer.
The one-legged tap dancer. And a guy named Pigmeat Markham, who later became famous on Laughing for Here Come to Judge. He would have
if we could, to the one-legged tap dancer, though.
All right.
Wouldn't seem to be a good career decision for someone with
he was a hell of a tap dancer, I guess. And he was on several times.
It's very difficult to explain to people nowadays how well anything about Señor Wences.
Your name? My name is Señor Wences. Oh. This is Gianni.
He was a Spanish ventriloquist who had two characters. He would draw a face, two little button eyes, and lipstick on his fist, and he would talk to this little guy named Johnny, or Yanni, as he called him.
How is your throat today? No, good. No, no, sure. Oh, this is nothing. No, no, listen to me. Follow me. Let me see one thing. Do, do, re, re, mi, mi, fa, fa, so, so, la, la, ti, ti, do, do. Good.
And then he had a disembodied head in a box, a guy with a beard in a box. And he would open and close the box and say, "It's all right." And the guy would say, "It's all right." But it would be muffled.
It's okay?
Yeah.
Hello, my friend. Not yet.
No.
Are you tired?
No.
Okay.
It's all right.
It was very peculiar, and the Sullivan's Ed Sullivan's taste was pretty mainstream. So for him, this was kind of far out stuff, but it caught on. And you know, as I say in the book, he didn't discover a lot of people, which is a misconception. He had people on who had already made it in other fields, whether they were recording artists or in nightclubs or movies or radio. So in a way, the show is a prism of what America was like in the 50s and 60s, because I always say that, you know, you can tell a lot about a country by what they choose to amuse themselves with.
Well, Mr. Nachman, nice talking to you.
Well, thank you, Scott. I appreciate being on very much.
Gerald Nachman, his new book. Can I do it one more time?
Yeah, go ahead.
Right here on this stage tonight, Ed Sullivan's America.
It's all right.
It's okay.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Britain's shivering through its coldest winter weather in 30 years. The Chinese capital of Beijing had its biggest one-day snowfall since 1951. And much of the U.S. is thawing out from an almost month-long freeze. But in one unexpected place, it's downright balmy, at least relatively speaking, and that place is the North Pole. It turns out parts of the Arctic are 10 to 15 degrees warmer than they should be at this time of year. So what's behind the unusual weather?
Well, I think it's all about the Arctic Oscillation.
That's Mark Serez. He's the director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and he joins me from Boulder. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And I understand that center is where the frozen are chosen?
That's right. The National Snow and Ice Data Center, where the frozen are chosen.
Where the frozen are chosen. Okay. So now that we've uncovered the culprit behind all this extra cold weather, explain what exactly Arctic Oscillation is.
All right. Well, if we look at the weather patterns over the Northern Hemisphere as a whole, sometimes we find that the surface pressure, the amount of atmospheric pressure we have, is a little lower in the Arctic than it is in the middle latitudes. And then sometimes it shifts, so the Arctic gets a little more and the mid-latitudes get a little less. Well, that shift in atmospheric mass or pressure is really how we define the Arctic Oscillation. But the interesting thing is that these shifts in pressure are associated with changes in weather that really reverberate throughout the Northern Hemisphere.
I'm sure, as you've seen, there have been some sort of climate change, let's call them skeptics, sort of suggesting that this disproves climate change. Does it have anything to do with it?
Well, what we're seeing here has nothing to do with global warming. What we're seeing is crazy weather. At the very same time that we've seen these areas in the middle latitudes with sub-zero temperatures and big snowstorms, the Arctic has been much, much warmer than normal.
Now, in December, the Arctic Oscillation went into what's called an extreme negative phase. Is that rare?
Well, what we've seen this December was certainly exceedingly rare. It would be like if you had a deck of cards and you told someone, well, I'm going to pull the ace of spades out of here, and you actually did it, right? Well, having us going into this extreme negative mode is even more rare than something like that.
Now, if the Arctic was much warmer over the past few weeks, does that affect the sea ice? I mean, presumably it means that the sea ice will melt more quickly.
On the one hand, with this extreme phase of the Arctic Oscillation, the Arctic has been very, very warm. That means less ice grows in the winter. On the other hand, the changing pattern of winds means that less ice in the Arctic gets transported out of the Arctic into the North Atlantic, where it would melt. So the Arctic kind of holds on to the ice that it has. Mm. So you have these competing effects. And who's going to win? We'll probably have the answers of that, say, sometime in April. We don't know right now.
I mean, do you have a sense of what this might mean for the Arctic and the summer ice melt?
I think it's going to have an overall negative effect. If you look at the extent of Arctic sea ice and compare it with normal, we're already about 1 million square kilometers in the hole.
Wow. Okay?
In other words, 1 million square kilometers below average. So it's not like the ice is really recovering from this. But we'll see what happens in the spring. The real fascination with climate science is there's a lot that we do understand, but there's a lot that we still don't.
That's Mark Serez. He's the director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Mark Serez, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.